Hey, Bobby Manning here, and welcome to Dome Theory number 52. A. Sherrod Blakely is joining us momentarily, the Boston Sports Journal NBA writer, as well as Bleacher Report's roving NBA writer, and recently wrote a piece in Ebony about black head coaching in the NBA. And I'm excited to get into that discussion with some of the openings around the league. We now have the Orlando Magic, Boston Celtics, Indiana Pacers, Portland Trail Blazers, among certainly more to come in terms of head coach openings. There's a bevy of candidates, assistants, college names being thrown around, former players trying to get their first shot at a head coaching opportunity in this league after Steve Nash did so well with no experience coming in, leading a powerhouse roster. Now, these circumstances in Portland, Boston, Indiana, Orlando especially, are going to be brutally difficult to manage, unlike walking into Kevin Durant, James Harden, Kyrie Irving, and a loaded roster of depth like Nash did. Not taken away from what he did there. These are just more consequential hires. You have culture questions in certain spots. Orlando is basically starting from square one in a rebuild here. So we talk about that with Sherrod, as well as under-discussed, especially in a sports context where so many of us are men covering these leagues, and there's an idolization of a lot of these figures who have been accused of sexual assault. And that comes into play here when we talk about Chauncey Billups, who in 1997 was sued, along with fellow rookie Ron Mercer, of rape at Antoine Walker's house. Both were playing for the Boston Celtics at the time. And the case was eventually ended in a settlement. Now, over the years that have gone by, Billups had a highly successful NBA career. Probably going to put him in the Hall of Fame when it's all said and done. Mr. Big Shot, the face of a Detroit Pistons team that became one of the more unlikely NBA champions in the last 20, 25 years here, beating the Los Angeles Lakers and making Rasheed Wallace, Ben Wallace, teams that our guest today, Sherrod Blakely, covered. Legends. He's gone on to do TV jobs. He's gone on to do an assistant coaching role now with the Clippers. And it never really feels like that question's been asked. Has he paid the appropriate amount of consequence for what he may or may not have done in 1997? That's where it gets difficult here. I, sitting in this chair, can't judge what Billups did. We have court documents, we have accusations, and I think it's behooving on us, especially now, to believe the allegations that are made against men, especially powerful men, and, you know, weigh them fairly. And fairly to me, in this circumstance where for so many years men have been given the benefit of the doubt in these circumstances, and we say, oh, don't falsely accuse someone. This could be a false accusation. This could be for money. This could be for this and that. We always try to talk our way out of these situations. It was a long time ago. What's done is done. Move on. Doesn't feel right to me because I'm still trying to answer this question of what is an appropriate consequence for this thing. Some people probably think it could be losing your career. You know, did Kobe, if he did what he did in Colorado, deserve to lose his NBA career? I can understand why someone would say yes to that. So now you're about to provide Chauncey Billups this next career. Didn't ultimately suffer major consequences. Paid a settlement. It's like paying a fine in the NBA. You look at it and you say it hurts, but you move on and it doesn't hurt you that much. So ultimately, what was the damage done to the victim there? I don't know who the victim is. I don't think anyone does. And we don't have a great idea of what damage was inflicted to her through this case and what followed there and what was left lingering with her in her life. It's a difficult discussion. I'm glad we got into it a bit here with Sherrod Blakely, because if Chauncey Billups is going to come into Boston and Portland as well, where it appears are Celtics Beat podcast here on CLNS Media, David Aldridge appeared and said that he thinks Billups is heading to Portland. Well, I've seen Portland's Reddit page call out against us too. Do we want to bring in this guy who has this in his past? Jason Kidd, domestic violence accusations in his past. What ultimately is the consequence in this circumstance? What's the media's role to play in it? And what does forgiveness look like? Should forgiveness easily be given? Because it does appear like it has been in the past. And does the level of forgiveness that we've given to these kind of people play into the continuation of a sexual assault culture that we certainly have in this country? Around sports, too. The masculinity of these environments, I think, makes it very difficult to hold each other accountable in these kind of circumstances when stuff like that goes on. So it is interesting to me, this case getting brought up so far. I know Bob Ryan said he didn't really hear about it at the time. Numerous people who were around the Celtics at that time, I don't remember it playing out in real time. That probably says a little something too. But he ultimately was traded, went on to have the career that he did. And I'm glad we're going to be able to discuss it here today on the show. Make sure you follow, subscribe to Dome Theory. We're at Dome Theory on Twitter. We are on Spotify, iTunes, Stitcher, all the different places you hear your podcasts. And we'll get into some Kemba talk here. We did a full episode on Kemba and trade scenarios. I also wrote about a bunch of Kemba trade scenarios on CLNS Media, so go check those out. I wrote about Jason Tatum this morning on Celtics blog as we still kind of dig our way out of the season that was a shocking season in Boston that still is going to lead to some seismic changes here. And we went through just about every single coaching possibility with A'Sherrod Blakely here, my co-host on the Garden Report, as I said, Bleacher Report, BSJ. Make sure you follow his work and check out his article that he wrote on Ebony about representation and coaching and what he wants to see out of this offseason when it comes to coaching hires. Report out of Boston today. Jake Fisher, who has written for numerous outlets now, saying that Boston's focus is indeed on hiring a black head coach and a former player for that change in perspective from Brad Stevens. So that's the route they want to go, and they feel like that can provide a shakeup in that room. That ultimately does seem to be what the purpose of the coaches in the NBA now. I love what Brad Stevens brought to the table for 8 seasons. I'm bummed to see him go without accomplishing that championship that it certainly feels like they could have if things broke their way in 2018 and then ultimately into 2019. They would have had a couple legit shots at a championship there. They certainly did in 2020, and it didn't pan out, and this past year went beyond the excuses to a point where effort became an issue. Intensity, game plan, locking in, adjustments, all those things came into play just as much as injuries and COVID did. So I'm not completely slamming the Celtics for moving on from Stevens, but I do think it's going to be important what direction they choose to go in here when it comes to the next voice in the room. There are numerous good candidates out there. But who's going to go to Portland? That's probably the big competition with Boston right now. But Boston, you would assume, with Tatum and Brown, does have the team, the resources, and the direction that a young, aspiring head coach would want to be a part of here, especially one of the more coveted ones. Is it going to be Billups? Is it going to be Kidd? Can they bring in that sort of baggage? What kind of questions need to be asked if it is one of those guys? That's the kind of stuff we're going to get into here on Dome Theory number 52. Here is A'Sherrod Blakely. And we welcome, as promised, the one, the only A'Sherrod Blakely from Bleacher Report, CLNS Media's A-List podcast, and my co-host on the Garden Report. Most importantly,
what's up, Bobby?
A'Sherrod, it's great to have you here. It's been great to have you at CLNS. I've loved doing the post-game show with you. I love the conversations. I love the insight, sourcing, all the different stuff you've brought to the table on the show. It's been crucial. I think when 5 of us are in there, it gets a little noisy. We start talking over each other and getting in each other's face. But
it should be.
As it should be. So welcome aboard. We got a ton of coaching candidates to talk about here. That's the biggest story in Boston right now is that they're going to have to replace Brad Stevens. I'm still in a little bit of shock over that press conference the morning after. I know I was just getting in from Texas that night. You remember I hopped on the show late.
Right.
I go to sleep that night, probably around 2 or 3. And I wake up at 10 and John's calling me like crazy saying, Danny Ainge's thinking about stepping down. I pick up my phone and all of a sudden by then Shams is tweeting about Brad. And still, how many conversations did we have during the year about whether they do this or do that? And it just seemed like they were going to kick that can down the road in terms of moves. And what they did was crazier than I think anybody expected or heard about. There was no rumors of Brad Stevens moving upstairs, and that is how they went about it. And I don't think we've talked a ton about it in the aftermath, but what was your reaction to that? And, you know, now that you've had 2 weeks to think it over, do you feel good about it?
My reaction initially was that it didn't really make sense to me. And only because I think when you have a coaching change and you're going to have a GM change, the two are usually two separate properties. It's like you're going to get your GM who will probably come from the outside, and then he's going to hire your new coach. It's rare that you get rid of your coach so that he can assume the position of your GM, and particularly with the kind of season that the Celtics had. I mean, I think if this team were playing in the conference finals and the season ended and they decided to make a move like this, I think it would be a little bit more palatable, because then you look at the season as being somewhat of a success and this being some means of rewarding that success. But this was a downer on every metric you'd use. This was not a good season for Brad, not a good season for the Celtics. And it just felt that Danny Ainge's decision to step away from the GM role, which I fully support, because again, you get the sense that a lot of this had to do with just his health, his family, and just really having more time to be with them. And I totally support him in that effort. But it felt as though moving Brad into his position was just more about just keeping a certain financial ramifications in check move, as opposed to let's go out and get the best person who can lead this organization going forward. And Brad may wind up doing a hell of a job, and we may all be talking about how this was the greatest just decision that they've made. But his body of work, even as a head coach, doesn't really make, I think, the average Celtics fan feel as though he's going to do a kick-ass job as the new GM. I mean, I don't know if you remember, but often when we talk about players that the Celtics might have interest in, you know, he would often defer this and just say, that's Danny and Austin and those guys' jobs. My job as a coach, I'm going to stay in my lane. That's not what we were hearing from, let's say, a Doc Rivers, who clearly wanted more power, more say near the end of his tenure. The guys who want that type of power, when they're asked about those type of things, they let it be known what their thoughts are. But then they'll be reminding us all that at someone else's job. But it would be pretty clear that that was something that they would have some interest in. And you just didn't get that sense from Brad. So I'm like most people. I really don't have a feel for how Brad is going to do in his new role, let alone how he's going to go about putting together whatever his checklist is going to be for who the new coach will be.
Well, I hope he's in it for the long haul, because obviously Jeff Goodman came on with us after it happened and put out there that it could just be a one-year deal. And ultimately, if Stevens ends up getting a coaching opportunity down the line here, he could jump right back into it once he finally gets the urge to do it again. I have no doubt about all the reasons they threw out there of why Ainge is stepping down and why Stevens is going upstairs and all the stuff about how it could work. It's just a strange transition, especially in the aftermath of what went on this year. You didn't really hear about a succession plan. You heard the talk of Ainge possibly stepping down if the year went a certain way from various different people. But you just never heard of this succession plan. And the answer that never truly got answered there is why Brad's no longer the coach. You would think he'd be a strength as a coach. He's done a great job over the years here. And there's no sign or indication outside of this weird thing that Wick threw out there about him looking good in the war room and being involved on certain decisions about him being a great GM. There's nothing to go off there. What kind of moves has he made? What kind of negotiations has he done? It's just so weird. It's one of the weirdest things I've ever watched covering this team. And I know I haven't done it for long, but I wonder if you agree with me just how weird that press conference was.
Well, it was weird because the thing that most of us were looking for was just some type of receipts that would justify or at a minimum explain why they were making this move.
Moving with no Brad search, really. Yeah, right. No, not going outside at all for another option.
particularly when you know that this offseason there's going to be arguably one of the top three, top four GMs who's going to be on the market, and that's Toronto's Mr. Bajaj. You know he's going to be, you know, a top candidate on almost any team that's looking for a GM's list. But I guess for me, I would have liked to have seen, in retrospect, think about moments where Brad showed some sign, some inkling that this was something he wanted. Whereas with Doc Rivers, we knew that Doc wanted more say. It was pretty clear that he wanted to have a little bit more input in what the franchise was doing. And to Doc's credit, you know, he'd been in the NBA a long time as a head coach. He's won a title. So for him to want to take that next step in his own personal growth, it made sense. But Brad has been here, you know, 8 years, and he's won a lot of games. There's only three coaches in Celtics history who've won more games, but he's the only one that hasn't won a title. And I always felt that that was going to be that one driving force that was going to keep him in the coaching world for the Celtics, because it's literally the only thing that keeps him from being, I think, fully accepted as one of this franchise's all-time great coaches. He's got the wins. He's really dealt with some really difficult circumstances, and he definitely deserves credit for that. But this team, this organization is about chips. It's about championships, and Brad did not get one. And this organization as a whole, I mean, as much as we, you know, we embrace the history of the Boston Celtics and how they're the most storied franchise in the league, and if no team has won more titles than them, you got to remember, they have one title in the last 35 years. One. There are seven other teams in the NBA in that window that have won multiple titles. So for Brad to step away from being the head coach, with that as a backdrop, that he is among the coaches who could not bring this franchise another title, to now be in position to where he's putting the pieces together to compete for a title, it seems an unusual and to some extent awkward transition when you look at his body of work as a coach and what they're going to need from the next GM who, again, to your point, Bobby, you're hoping he's going to be in that role for an extended period of time. And this just is a 1 year layover till Mike Krzyzewski, who, by the way, right around the time that all this was happening in Boston, Krzyzewski announces that he's only going to do this for another year. And so that's something that you better believe that people are going to be keeping an eye on and see if whether, you know, Stevens may wind up, you know, at least being open to the process of going to Duke as their head coach, which, if we're being honest and real with each other, I don't think any of us would be surprised by that all.
Well, I was surprised that Duke and North Carolina went to their top guys on the bench. All right, not doing an extensive search, it seems, going after some high-profile guys like Jay Wright and others who are on the college game. You know what, though,
Bobby? Here's the thing. I spent 5 years down there in Tobacco Road covering the ACC, and I covered Duke before I left, and that's how they roll. I mean, they are very big on keeping all that stuff internal, kind of like the Celtics in many respects. They don't really like to look outside of what they call the Tar Heel family or the Blue Devil family. And that's why Brad is not necessarily a natural, obvious target for Duke. But if they were going to look outside of the Duke family, Brad is the kind of guy that they would look for. He fits very much in line with the type of coach that they would want representing them, a little bit more so than Jay Wright, who I think is a great coach. I just don't think that he's a Tobacco Road type of great coach.
For sure. And anybody who's stepping in those roles is going to be huge. We'll talk about that in a little bit. But when it comes to the Celtics, Brad moving upstairs, this is such a pivotal moment. You would always want any GM to be in the seat for a long time because all the decisions you're going to make have long-term implications. You think of how Daryl Morey ended his tenure in Houston. Right. Knowing that he could be out the door at any moment kind of changed how he approached things, it felt like. And he made some disastrous mistakes down the stretch there. They're going to put Houston back for years. Mm-hmm. Now, what kind of expectations are going to be on Brad? What kind of big decisions is he going to be making individually? Are there going to be other people involved? There's just a million different questions about how he's going to go about this. I don't know what kind of GM he's going to be like. Is he going to try to copy everything Ainge did? Is he going to try to be Ainge? Or is he going to bring his own flair to it and try to build the team that he wanted that he wasn't satisfied with Ainge making in the past few years here? It's going to be very interesting. I did like his comment about finding a coach who brings some of his similarities while also key differences. I think that was a good way to go about what's going to be a crucial coaching search here.
But I think there's another factor we have to consider here, too. And I went down to Brooklyn for game two of the Nets series, and Nick was laughing at me. John was laughing at me. But when I said this, because the Nets just have such a horrible history as a franchise. I was asking earlier in the year, who's the worst franchise in the NBA? And there's a handful that you can throw out there, but the Nets are down there in terms of all-time success. You know, just not a great brand. Few great players here, there in their history, few nice runs, but overall just, you know, one of the biggest losers in the league. But now when I go down there, the crowd was fantastic. We've heard the things that they've done about giving out half price tickets and getting, you know, different kinds of people in the crowd there. I love their uniforms. I love their court. I love their branding. I love all the different things they've done to change their perception. And they've had a few tough injuries here, but if they're fully healthy, they look like they could be the championship favorite. So my point here is there's been a lot of talk around the Celtics over their, you know, last few weeks here with the Kyrie bottle throwing incident, people making comments about Boston City, you know, as a place people want to play, the franchise, the issues that Marcus Smart, Tristan Thompson went through here. This is not only a pivotal time for them in terms of their roster, in terms of their championship contention, Tatum, Brown, all those things. But they also have to change their perception as a franchise a little bit around the league. I know they won't want to fold completely to criticisms like Anthony Davis's agent that were probably made in bad faith to some degree. But at the same time, we know there's real issues here. And Ainge coming out saying he's never heard about racism in the crowd for 26 years just wasn't the right look. I had Dart Adams on a couple of weeks ago, and it's like, really? The organization didn't make a statement about it. They had Jaylen Brown come out and basically, you know, make a statement there on his own behalf about how he felt about the situation. But Stevens being the guy to lead the franchise forward just feels like they're going to do a lot of the same here in terms of how they've run things. And, you know, it'd be great if they can have a black coach come in and, you know, identify more with the players and be one of the leaders and speak for the organization. You've written about this in the last week or so, but I almost think they have to do an entire overhaul. They built a great practice facility that helps. You know, they've done a few things here there to modernize different jerseys, stuff like that. But I still feel like they haven't gone to the extra lengths that they need to connect with the city of Boston and really show that they're evolving and trying to push for the change in perception that they need to here.
Well, I think one of their biggest challenges, Bobby, is that the organization has an idea, concept on how they view diversity and how they can implement that. And then there's the city itself. And what I think often happens is that the two are conflated, that the Celtics, the organization, is often seen as the equivalent or the same as Boston, the city, or New England, the you know, just the region. And it's a false narrative that I think the Celtics, you know, they're in a tough spot because you want those people in New England to be that's your fan base. So you have to embrace them. But at the same time, embracing them, there's a lot of good that comes with that. And there's a lot of bad that comes with that. And I think it's very challenging for them to really find that happy medium. You know, one of the things that is often overlooked in Brad Stevens' tenure was there was a point where the Celtics had more black assistant coaches than any team in the NBA. When you're talking about Walter McCarty, Jerome Allen, Micah Shrewsbury, you had a couple other folks who were behind the scenes. And it got little to no play nationally, certainly not in this region. And the reason why was because those people, they just happened to have that one common character trait in common with each other. They were all, when you looked at all of their bios and resumes, they were clearly qualified for the job. But it's just that under Brad, they had an opportunity to be on an NBA staff. And that's really what I think Brad is going to bring to the table. I think Brad recognizes the importance of creating a culture that is about creating opportunities. That's why you had a Carol Lawson added to your staff. That's why Brad was an NBA head coach, because Danny Ainge gave him an opportunity that if you were to look at his body of work, he did a great job at the college level. But as we know, college coaches have not fared well historically when they make the transition to the NBA. And yet he still got that opportunity. So I think when you look at Brad, the way he will construct the coaching staff, or excuse me, whoever his head coach will be. And I think also the way that he will look at evaluating talent, I think Brad is going to do that with more of a I need to find the best fit for this particular organization, as opposed to finding the best head coach or the best player. And that, to me, that's part of the mindset that creates really good teams, as opposed to really good players who may not necessarily be a good team. And so I think that's one of the things that I think Brad will distinguish himself from Danny Ainge, because I think Danny Ainge, I think that there's a certain part of Danny Ainge that followed that path, but I think Brad is going to amplify that even more so. And frankly, Bobby, that's, I think, the way that they will help change the narrative about Boston, because I think they're going to have a roster, both in terms of the coaching staff, in terms of the players. And certainly, I think, Brad, don't be surprised if we see some tweaks to the front office and you see some folks brought into the fold that have a different look, a different perspective, a clear and undefined uniqueness about them that we haven't seen before, become part of that brain trust, because they've got to do a better job of hitting on players outside of the lottery. Danny Ainge, one of the better GMs, if you look at the last 5-10 years, as far as what he gets in those top five, top 10 picks, he nails them consistently. Once he gets outside of the lottery, that's where your talent evaluators really have to come through. And I don't think they've done a good enough job in that regard, particularly when you look at some of the players that they made moves on and how those players panned out versus players that they had an opportunity to draft that they didn't. The two that jump out, I think, to most Celtics fans are certainly when you pass on a guy like Giannis Antetokounmpo and you moved up that year in the draft and you got Kelly Olynyk. And then before that, you know, when you take a guy like Juwan Johnson near the end of the first round, and at the very end of the draft, there's a guy named Jimmy Butler. And I know Butler was on their short list of folks that they were considering at that point in the draft. But again, you've got to have evaluators who can nail that stuff, at least at a higher rate than what we've seen. And I do think that Brad is going to create, I think, a brain trust that is going to be a little bit more all-encompassing and give them, I think, a better chance to hit some home runs in the latter stages of the first round, which is where, if they continue to play the way they have, I think they're going to consistently be drafting in their early to mid-20s.
Yeah, and I tend to agree with that evaluation of Brad. He's a listener. He's taking advice from other people. He's willing to hear everybody out on a variety of different things here. I liked his vocal leadership in the bubble. When it came to the protests there, he was working in a coaches committee at that time. I think that's going to be an important differentiation from Ainge, who, you know, for better or worse, was just going to do things his way in terms of his ideology and how he managed the roster, which had great successes and difficult moments as well. That 2019, not only the back half of it with all the Anthony Davis talk and everybody's name being thrown around in trades that year and him openly discussing the pursuit there. Tough situation to be in. I compare it to that LeBron season out there in LA. It was a tough season for them too, where everybody's head was under the cloud of trade talks. And looking back on it, probably two wasted opportunities for those franchises looking down the line. And then once that Kyrie departure came and went, you basically had a situation here where they signed Kemba, jumped back into contention with a move like that, but on draft night, dumped veterans and basically wiggled their way out to get all that cap space for Kemba by going cheap with rookies and guys who basically weren't ready for that moment in 2020, and Romeo Langford and Grant Williams and Edwards and Waters, and just a giant influx of young talent that still to this day really hasn't developed into what they probably would have hoped it would be. And it can happen, but that's why you don't build your bench out with deep first round picks and second round picks, Semi Ojeleye and others. Great players, but are they reliable? Are they winners? Are they guys who you can throw in the playoff games and rely on for key minutes? It ultimately showed to be no through two tough seasons there in 2020's closing run and then 2021, what we just watched last year. So that ultimately is what did Ainge in. I don't think it condemns his career. He has a championship. He's made numerous brilliant moves throughout the years and has been one of the better GMs in the sport, but it did feel like a time for change. So I think you can look at it a positive in that sense. Stevens will be interesting, though. I loved him as a coach. I thought he deserved one more shot. Maybe he'll do well as a GM. I think this, if you want to be dubious about it, you have your fair shot there. There's reasons you can think of why he might be successful. But again, he's stepping in the big shoes, and we just don't know how long he's going to be heading in that direction for, though. So overall, I think it's a good transition point for the team. But they're in a tough spot now. You're going to move Kemba? It's a big question.
It's a huge question.
He was one of the biggest free agents they ever signed. Now you're hearing about some beef between him and the organization. Maybe they just want to move on mutually and amicably. But if stuff's floating out there around him, there's probably a little bit of tension there that his name's been in trade talks. I think it'd be a great thing to get a guy back like Al Horford, who you can look at and say left the organization. You don't know why. I see you laughing there. No, but I think it'd be a good thing to have a guy come back in who they said, why'd Horford leave Boston? And all of a sudden he's willing to come back here.
Yeah, here's the thing about Al leaving Boston. The reason why Al left Boston, if we want to really just cut to the chase, was because Al and his camp they had an idea of what his value was, and the Celtics didn't agree. And the Celtics were basically, it was a game of chicken where the Celtics were like, if you think you're worth more money, by all means, go and get it. And Al, his camp was, okay, well, not only will we get the money, but we're going to be in a situation that, on paper at least, was better than the situation he was in Boston. And I don't think there's any question. You look at that Sixers team when they had Al Horford on paper, they were a much better team and a clear, legitimate contender to come out of the East. Obviously, none of us knew just how dysfunctional things would be with Al and Joel, which to me, it's still a little bit kind of a bit of a head scratcher when you consider how Al, at that point in his career, was the one player that Joel consistently had issues with that just seemed to own him. I mean, those memes where Al, there's a picture of Al holding a baby and it's Joel Embiid, that was real. that felt very real to me. When I watched the Celtics and Sixers play when Al was here, that felt very real. That this was, you know, this was Papa showing young son, this is how you're supposed to play the game. And if you're not going to play the game like this, my team's just going to steamroll over you, and I'm not even going to have to be the one to drive it. My teammates are going to do that, and I'm just going to pitch here and there, keep you in check, make sure you don't get out of line. And that's kind of what Al did, you know, when he was at Celtics. And for Embiid not to have that impediment on another roster, I was expecting the Embiid that we've seen this past year, I thought that guy was going to be there with Al Horford, and it just never happened. But to your point, Al coming back, I can understand why they might want to do that, just for the familiarity's sake. And if you're Brad Stevens, you know, Al's one of those guys you trust. Al's one of those guys that you know has tremendous leadership ability and is not going to do anything while he's on the payroll that's detrimental to the team. He's not going to grumble and gripe if he's not getting the kind of minutes that he thinks he deserves. He's just going to be the good soldier. But I don't know whether the resources that you would be allocating towards Al justify what he's going to bring to this team in terms of on and off the court production. I'm a huge Al Horford fan. He's one of the I've known Al ever since he was in high school back in Grand Rapids, Michigan. And I used to cover the Pistons out there. And so I knew the kid that was going to Florida was pretty damn good. Now, that being said, I don't think I would make a deal for Al, because here's the thing about the Thunder. They're not doing anything unless they're getting picks. You know that. I mean, if you say, hey, look, I want.
Well, you know how I feel about picks.
I do. I mean, if they say, hey, we want a popsicle and a blow pop, we also want a second round pick attached with that. That's just how they are. And if you're the Celtics, again, your roster is kind of evolving. You've got to get some back-end talent that can help bolster that bench. And you've got to continue to develop players. So I would be a little bit leery of giving them too sweet of a draft pick. Like, if we're talking like multiple second-round picks, by all means, help yourself, Oklahoma City. But when you're talking about first-rounders, see, I'm leery of giving up any of those if it involves someone like Al, because I think, again, with this new brain trust, I think they're going to do a better job of finding those diamonds in the rough in the latter stages of the first round. And if they're able to do that, you got to have the picks there. So if we're talking about Al Horford and we're talking about giving up picks, second rounders, help yourself. First rounders, I would much more be comfortable giving you two or three second rounders than I would a late first round pick or a heavily protected first round pick. I think those things have tremendous value, particularly for a team like Boston, where, and again, I think they're going to start hitting more home runs with a new, more, I think, broad-minded brain trust in the room of decision making.
They are in a tough spot when it comes to those picks. They're lucky they have seven here, because you do have to balance compensating a team for taking on Walker, trying to fill those TPE spots. Those are going to require some picks going out the door. And then if you eventually want to swing for another star, it's going to take a substantial amount of picks. So the more you sprinkle those out there, the less you're going to have for that final goal eventually, trying to get another guy in here. But you also have to get Walker out of here if you want that cap space in 2023. And there's only a few different ways you can do that. I am worried, because if they really did try to move Walker for LaMarcus Aldridge, and we remember what LaMarcus Aldridge was looking like at the end there in San Antonio, it's not looking great in terms of being able to move him if they couldn't get something like that done.
I'm shocked if that was on the table and the Spurs didn't jump all over that. Because, I mean, just thinking about him on their roster, they become that in that 4, 5, 6 conversation last year if he's on their roster. Even with him, you know, missing games and the whole load management thing, I still think that that team, when you look at the players they have, you look at the versatility that they have, you look at the damn coach that they have, that team becomes exponentially better. And if they couldn't get San Antonio to budge on that, and the way the season ended for the Celtics as far as his health is concerned, it's going to be, again,
that medical is so key. I mean, nobody might take him if the medical doesn't look right.
and the problem that they're going to run into is that teams are going to throw that in their face. And so if they're thinking that we can take a little bit of a hit if we give them maybe a protected first and maybe an unprotected second, teams are going to say, well, because of the medical, we're going to need one unprotected first and a protected first, and maybe we're going to need a second rounder that's also unprotected. And if at that point it's just like, basically you're trying to, you might as well show up with a ski mask and a bag and something in your pocket, because you are totally trying to rob me. You are absolutely sticking me up in that moment. And the Celtics have historically not been the team. They haven't been the one for that. That doesn't really happen to them. And I don't think Brad's first deal as the Celtics GM is one where he's going to allow that to happen. I think they're going to look for an amicable deal. I mean, if you, for example, the Knicks are going to have a ton of cap space, and so they can easily absorb.
That's the dream. That's the dream for them.
And even if the Knicks said, you know what, if they're going to absorb him into their cap space, they're not going to ask for nearly as many picks as, let's say, the OKC would. So you could theoretically unload him, have that contract off your books, and it not cost you as much, you know, intangible collateral, i.e. draft picks, as it would with some other teams.
You think New York would consider that?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Wow. Absolutely. There's no doubt that the Knicks will consider making a run at Kemba Walker this offseason. That is absolutely going to happen. Because when they look at how their season ended, it was pretty clear they needed another upper echelon type scorer. When you look at Kemba when he's healthy, which is a big if, obviously. But when you look at that, you look at the fact that he's a New Yorker, your kid is from the Bronx, some of the best games he's played in his life have come on that Madison Square Garden floor. And you remember, Kemba, and he talked about this after he had signed with Boston, that the Knicks were on a short list of teams that he was seriously considering. So it's not like, and that was before the Knicks had shown the kind of growth that we saw this past season. So if they're clearly a team that has shown growth and they're on the rise, and that was an organization that you were thinking about before, and you're from that neck of the woods, and some of your best games as a basketball player have been on that floor, it makes a whole lot of sense if you are being told that they're looking to trade for you to be like, yep, I'm cool with that. And if you're the Celtics, you know, you'll see him 4 times a year, but again, if you're smart and you're utilizing that space that his departure will create, it won't matter, because you'll be able to find some pieces. And I say plural, not singular, because I think if you were to move him, I think you need to start cobbling together some talent as opposed to one player. It's going to help you in the long run to get closer to your goal, which is to bring Banner 18 to Boston.
It will be interesting because the Knicks can do so many different things. I mean, they have to pay Randall here. They have to pay Rose, I believe, as well. And just a bunch of different other things. And they'll basically, with the cap space you mentioned, have their choice in free agency. It's not a great class, but they could go after a guy like DeMar DeRozan and a couple other people out there. The choices aren't great, but when you think of Walker's health and availability, just having a star who can be there every night, I think, is going to be more enticing than bringing in Walker and dealing with those question marks. Again, it killed the Celtics this year when you look back on it, dealing with him being in, him being out for extended run here. And then at, right at the end, when they need him in the Brooklyn series, he's gone the last two games. So that that can really kill a team in just in terms of their consistency and you know, their balance and figuring out how to play with each other and all those things. It's going to be really tough, but it'll be a huge bailout if the Celtics can get that done. So let's talk coaches. There's so many names out here. You know quite a few of them, so I'm looking to get some insight on these guys and get it out to our viewers here on Dome Theory, just what to expect from all these names that are being thrown around. You have some more likely ones that I think we'll emphasize here, and then some less likely ones that probably aren't in the fold. But the Celtics are casting a wide, wide net here in terms of who they're looking at. Other NBA coaches who have just been released in recent years here, college names, internal names. I thought that was always going to be the hardest part for Brad. What's he going to do with Larrañaga and Jerome Allen and Scott Morrison and these types? And he gave them their first shot. So I wouldn't be stunned if it's one of those guys, but I do think everybody's expecting an outside voice here to come in and change things up. And our good friends at Bet Online put Ime Udoka as the favorite, a slight favorite. Basically, everybody was the same odds there. But Udoka being number one was interesting to me. A Nets assistant, worked with Brett Brown in Philadelphia, longtime Popovich assistant, as well as a former player in this league. Checks a couple boxes in terms of mixing it up from Stevens, and you do hear great things about him coming out of Philadelphia last year. It really felt like he was going to get a head coaching opportunity, but like a number of head coaches or guys who could have been head coaches in another spot, went on to Brooklyn and built this powerful bench for Steve Nash this year that has done so well with that team. So what do you got on Udoka? How do you think he would fit in Boston, and what kind of changes would he bring to the bench?
Well, you know, Udoka is an interesting one. He is taking a path that I think a lot of folks don't seem to recognize, but it is absolutely vital if you're going to be an NBA head coach. And that is, you cannot be someone who is lumped slash locked in with one coach, and that's how they think of you. You know, when he was Popovich gave him his first opportunity, but had he stayed a Popovich assistant, that's how he would be viewed. And the one thing that, and I went through this with Terry Stotts years ago when he was first trying to get on as a head coach, he was very close with George Karl. He played for George Karl in the CBA. He had been an assistant for George Karl for years. And when he finally started interviewing with teams, they would basically say, well, you know, we like you, but you're basically a young George Karl. We don't want a young George Karl. If we want a George Karl, we just go out and make a play for him. So you need to show your ability to work in different systems with different types of management structures. And then, you know, that's going to help you become an NBA head coach. And that's exactly what Terry Stotts did. He was in Dallas for a little bit and a couple other places. And he's been at a multitude of head coaching jobs. Udoka, same way. He left the Popovich nest, and he's been in Philly. He's now in Brooklyn, working for, you know, Sean Marks, the GM, who longtime Spurs guy as well. He's someone I think has he has a very calm demeanor. I think in many respects he's similar to Brad from a temperament standpoint. He's not a big yell, you know, rah-rah kind of guy. Is very smart, high basketball IQ, will definitely put the Celtics in a position to be successful. My only concern with him is that when I think about him and I talk to people about him, a lot of the boxes that are checked off are very Brad Stevens-like. And I think Brad is looking for someone who is more of not necessarily a clone, but a complement of what he did as a coach, that there will be some things that they have in common, but there will be some clear and undeniable elements that separate them. And obviously, you know, Udoka with his experience as a player in the league certainly helps. But I think that the pool of candidates that the Celtics are going to be looking at, I'm not sure if he's going to rise to the top, but he's definitely someone who has put in enough time to where, at a minimum, he needs to be given serious consideration. And if you're talking about the top three, top four candidates, I think he's kind of on the bubble for being, you know, maybe that number three, number four possibility.
Well known fact to me, engaged to Nia Long.
See, I wasn't going to bring that up. I was going to strictly focus on the basketball and the coaching tree and all that, because as Kevin Durant has clearly pointed out, we need to focus on basketball. We don't need to talk about the stuff outside of basketball. So right. I'm trying to endorse the Kevin Durant plan of discussions about this type of stuff and keep it all on the game.
And I'm bringing the rest of the table.
Yes, you are. Yes, you are, Bobby. Yes, you are.
Sam Cassell, popular name, former Celtic, champion in Boston, champion in Houston, a bunch of different teams, longtime assistant now. He's been waiting. Another guy like Udoka. When's he going to get his opportunity? It's going to be a theme here.
Yeah, is he
a real deal candidate here for Boston?
I want to say no. It has more to do with the other candidates than it does Sam. I think Sam at some point will get an opportunity, but I don't think this is that opportunity. I still think that, again, the other candidates, I just feel a stronger leadership and understanding how to make things work. Well, if Sam were to get the job, it's going to be pivotal for all the candidates, but for him specifically, having the right assistants. You gotta believe that the Celtics are going to keep at least one or two of the current assistants for the new regime. I'm getting that sense that they're not going to bring in a coach who's just going to bring in a completely new set of assistant coaches. So you're going to have a couple layovers, and I'm not sure if Sam is going to – I don't think the staff that Sam will put together will have enough depth and strength that's going to compensate for what some of the growing pains he's going to have as a head coach. I just don't think it's going to happen. But Sam, again, I think, like I said, I think it's worth having him in the conversation, but I just don't – I get the sense that he's probably not going to be one of the finalists.
So this one's interesting, coming out from Woj last week, that Darvin Ham and Charles Lee will be considered longtime Budenholzer guys. Mm-hmm. I do view the Budenholzer system and the way they manage their teams there to be something that Brad would appreciate. And who knows, if Budenholzer becomes available down the line here, maybe he would enter this fold as well. But that stuck out to me, the fact that two longtime Budenholzer guys are on this list.
Yeah, I'm not too familiar with Charles Lee, other than the fact that he has been a name that the last couple of years has popped up as someone to keep an eye on as far as being, you know, someone that may be getting that opportunity sooner rather than later. Darvin Ham is someone I'm very familiar with his time in Detroit, and also, you know, when he was with the Lakers and with the Bucks and Atlanta Hawks under Bud. Darvin gives you that tough leadership component that I think the Celtics are definitely going to be more in tune with this hire than they have been in the past. Darvin is as self-made an NBA player as you're going to find out there. This is a guy that, you know, I think his career average is like 2.3 points or something like that, but he was in the league for like 12 years. That does not happen if you aren't bringing something to the table from an intangible standpoint that teams feel they absolutely have to have. And so, for Darvin, you know, it won't be as challenging for him to convince the Grant Williams of the world to do a little bit more than what you're doing. He can relate to those guys, I think, a little bit better than a lot of coaches, because he's been there. He knows what it's like to be on the fringe of being in the NBA and finding your role that can help the team be successful. So I think for him, you know, he's going to do a really good job with whatever team he winds up being a head coach of. I think do a really good job of strengthening those guys on the edges, on the fringes, and guys who have to be better to make your stars better. So in many respects, he would be someone that would bring some very unique skills to the table in Boston because of the just, I think, the work he does in developing players, and not necessarily star players, but just the guys around the star players who, as we know, when you get to the playoffs, you need those guys beyond just your stars to win and advance. And so Darvin, I think he would be a solid hire, but I'm not sure if he would be your number one pick. I don't think he would be, but I do think he's good enough, and I think he's been in the game long enough to where he has to be in the conversation.
And then we have Carol Lawson. Interesting. Very, one. Hasn't been named as an interview candidate. I still don't know where this idea comes from that she would be among the top choices here. Obviously, they loved her, and obviously she was here for a year and has connections to the people. But in terms of a shakeup, in terms of a different voice, I don't know if it goes in that direction. And then there's the experience factor and the fact that she just got to Duke and coached a few games before shutting that season down for them, which I loved. I did a whole segment on YouTube about that and that bold move she made to shut that program down for the year. But doesn't strike me as a likely one, although it's a good conversation to have.
It is. And certainly the fact that she has been in Boston was a factor in her name kind of being brought in there. But to your point, from what I'm hearing, she's probably not going to make the cut, and I don't believe she's going to interview with the team. Because remember, she has a handful of games under her belt at Duke. And so I think from her standpoint, I think there is a certain loyalty to that Duke program. And particularly when you're looking at a Celtics situation where you are not the clear-cut favorite. I think if that were the case, then we might be having a different kind of conversation. But you got to understand, with someone like Kara, not only are you, you know, if you were to enter this, you know, candidacy, you're trying to be the last one standing, but you've got rival schools, you know, who will use your candidacy against you when it comes to recruiting. Yes. So if you don't get the Celtics job, you may have trouble building upon what you've already started there at Duke. And I just don't think Kara is willing to run the risk of that. So I think that she's going to probably take a cue from Juwan Howard and just put the word out that she's not trying to go to the NBA right now. And, you know, again, that's another person whose name was popped out there real quick. And he nipped that in the bud ASAP, making it absolutely clear. And he did that in part because of the success he's had there, but also for what I just pointed out. He understands the recruiting game. And you can't – whatever knock that a rival coach can have against you, they will use that as – they will weaponize that as much as they can. And I give Juwan kudos for recognizing that and nipping that in the bud right away. Kara, I suspect we're going to hear within the next few days her doing something similar to that and just ending all talk and speculation about her in the NBA.
He has a high state class coming in too, Howard. Yeah. You know, I heard the best since the Fab Five there at Michigan after a great debut season for him. So big stakes there. I'm sure he wants to win a championship there before he even thinks about making that leap. But, you know, you want to have that sure-fired shot if you're going to even entertain that leap to the NBA. It's a great point there. A handful of names we'll run through as well. Lloyd Pierce, tough finish in Atlanta. There was a huge ruckus made when he was fired midway through the season there in the pandemic year, along with just the representation discussion in the league. Now, it went right to you know, Nate McMillan, who did a fantastic job, probably should have been considered more heavily in the coach of the year conversation for the turnaround that Atlanta had after he took over. So probably the right move. But I do remember Brad Stevens defending him vehemently after he was dismissed there in Atlanta and just bummed. I think numerous coaches around the league were bummed to see him end up out of a job there. And I saw him on some weird app, like breaking down the NBA playoffs. I was like, when's Lloyd going to come back into the league? He's just talking on this app right now. But it looks like the Celtics will interview him and give him a serious shot here, taking over the organization. It wasn't a great tenure in Atlanta, so obviously he'll have to bounce back from that. It is good to see a black coach get a second chance after not succeeding. But I don't know, would he be among the top ones to you?
I don't think so. And here's why. Lloyd is one of the more respected young minds in the game. You will be hard pressed to find anyone that has anything negative to say about Lloyd. But I just think where the Celtics are as an organization, Lloyd Pierce, I don't believe is the answer. What I could see happening, and I think this will happen, it would not surprise me if Lloyd Pierce is the lead assistant on whoever the next coach will be, which I think would be a great role for him at this point, because it will afford him an opportunity to be honest and real, to kind of get back some of that credibility that that took a hit when he got fired in Atlanta. If he were to be the lead assistant, I don't believe he'd be here long term. I think he'd be here for maybe a year, maybe two tops, because I do think that Lloyd can have that type of impact. I mean, Lloyd is, I think his player development historically has been really good. And when you look at the Celtics team, you've already got your two stars in Tatum and Brown. And I would just say this, I believe those two guys are a lot more easier to manage than, let's say, a Trae Young is. Because remember, in Atlanta, you had Trae Young, you had John Collins, and there was a little bit of friction there. And I don't think Lloyd handled that quite as well as he would have liked in retrospect. So I think a lead assistant role for him would be great, because I think for the Celtics, you have someone who is beyond qualified for that role. And for Lloyd, it would be an opportunity with a very high-profile program to really get out there and get your name back in the mix for a head coaching job in the next head coaching cycle. So Lloyd's a guy that I definitely I could see in that lead assistant role, but not the head man.
Now, Becky Hammond, not on the interview list yet, but has been tossed around. 6-time WNBA All-Star, Spurs assistant since 2014, heir apparent possibly to Greg Popovich, but if you do get a job opportunity, you kind of have to hop at it while it's there. Who knows how long Pop's going to do this, or what the Spurs will even consider when he ends up moving on with his long flowing hair down there in San Antonio. Maybe she sticks that out. Maybe that's the plan down there, that she'll take over when he's done. But do you think the Celtics will make a run at her anyway?
I think they, at a minimum, should have a conversation and just really feel her out, get a sense of whether she would be a good fit here. Because, again, her credentials demand that she get interviews for this job. She has done as much as any other man who's going to be on any short list. I mean, you look at her playing career. You look at her roles as a leader. I mean, granted, a summer league title is nothing to just put up on your mantle and flagpole. But it was her first time getting an opportunity to coach a men's team, and she won it all. She was the last one standing, you know, when she coached the Spurs Summer League team to a championship. And to me, you know, when I think about, you know, coaches who get opportunities here and there in the middle of the season to be a head coach, and I think about what she did, it's as impressive, if not more impressive, what she did in the summer, particularly when you talk about a lot of players were just kind of cobbled together, and you've got to figure out on the fly how to make this thing work. And for her to win a championship, it says a lot about her. I think Becky Hammond is going to be a good head coach. It's just a matter of who's going to have the courage to make that decision. I think she's going to be the first one. I think she should be the first one. And after her, I think you're going to see the Dawn Staleys of the world get opportunities. I think, you know, your Teresa Weatherspoon, who is an assistant down in New Orleans, I think she at some point should be considered, not for this job per se, but definitely down the road. That's another one to keep an eye on, because the time has come where that change has to come. And I do think Becky Hammond, of all the folks that we talk about, is the most likely to get that opportunity. And the Celtics, you know, historically have been about change, even when that change put them in a position where it put them in opposition, or it put them separate from the rest of the league. When you talk about being the first organization to draft a Black player, first all-Black starting five, first Black head coach, first Black head coach to win a championship. The list of firsts that this sort of Celtics organization has had when it comes to making significant societal changes is a long and lengthy one. And Becky Hammond, again, at minimum, should be talked to see if there's something there. And last but certainly not least on the Becky Hammond train, her coach, the coach that she works under, Greg Popovich, nobody pushed and gave Brad Stevens more credit for being "he belongs in our league" from day one than Greg Popovich. And there's a part of me that believes that is going to make Brad, at a minimum, interview her, if for no other reason, out of just frankly, the support that Popovich gave him when Popovich didn't have to. I mean, Popovich could have looked at him as just this young, up-and-coming whippersnapper who really hasn't done anything in the NBA. Butler, it's one thing to win in Butler, but this, look, this isn't, you know, this is not a mid-major conference. This is the NBA. None of that. He was absolutely on the Brad Stevens train from day one, and I do think as Brad starts looking at all the possible candidates, I do think that Becky Hammon, from her credentials alone, she should get an interview. But if that doesn't impress Brad enough, the connection with Pop should.
Mike D'Antoni on this list, too, from Brooklyn. Low-key personality, one of the great offensive minds of our time. But as you and I know, this team's issue wasn't offense last year. It was defense.
It was, which is why I just don't think D'Antoni is going to have a shot. And frankly, I don't think he'd want to come to Boston for that very reason, because he would be called upon to institute a better defense, and because the offense was pretty damn good. So for him, I just don't see this being a good fit for what he does and what they need.
Jamal Mosley in Dallas. Not too familiar with him, an assistant there. I know Steven Silas just came off that bench and had a tough time in Houston, but did pretty good in Dallas. And, you know, Mosley has overseen some good teams there as well. What do you got on him?
Jamal has been around for a while. He's bounced around a couple of different places, never played in the NBA, but has played professionally, was a really good player in college. I think he's right now I don't think he's going to quite rise to the top as far as the candidate is concerned. But I love the fact that he's in the mix because, again, I think his body of work is – I think it's detailed enough and it's extensive enough to where he deserves at a minimum to be in some of these conversations. But I do think that more likely than not, he's either going to stay on that Dallas staff or he's going to be an assistant somewhere else. And I think – lead assistant is probably the next realistic, I think, benchmark for Jamal. But I think he's going to be a pretty good coach one day because, again, he comes from that player development world. That's really one of his strengths. And so a young, up-and-coming team looking for a coach that's really going to kind of get after it a little bit and just, you know, try to instill a certain type of work ethic, I think Jamal will be a good addition. But I just think the Celtics are a little bit further down the road from where I think Jamal – starting point as a head coach is going to be.
I do like the idea of some developers coming in here, particularly for a young team in assistant roles. So that'll be interesting to watch which one of these guys could possibly leap into the assistant spot. You mentioned Pierce in that sense. The last two we're going to talk about here come with some baggage. One of them popular, one of them not so popular. The one everyone's just kind of like, get out of here, is Jason Kidd. Not all that successful in Milwaukee with a pretty, as we saw under Budenholzer, strong team. Was it that 8-1 series there after he got fired with who was the assistant there who stepped in against Boston? I can't even remember his name, but
he was bad.
It was just such a funny look, and that ended up being a 7-game series, and you saw what the Bucks were ultimately going to become against Boston there in round one. It was an awesome series, but Kidd did not get it done there, gets his second chance in L.A. I think everyone was wondering, who's going to actually be the one to rise above here, Vogel or Kidd behind them. But now Kidd's getting some opportunities. He knocked down the Portland one because of Damian Lillard's vocal support of him for that position. And there's just, you know, he's got domestic violence in his past and just numerous other things that people are bringing up now about him as a personality, him as a person, that, you know, both fans in Portland I've heard from as well as Boston don't want him in the mix here. But he was one of the first names you heard when that opening came up in Boston. So what do you make of Kidd getting a second shot in this league? Obviously a brilliant player, experienced point guard, all those things. But in his previous stop, did not do a great job.
I think he should get a second shot, and I think he will get a second shot, but it will not be in Boston. I've talked with people close to Kidd who made it clear that he's very interested in the Celtics job, very interested. But I don't think the feeling's mutual. The one thing the Celtics are about is culture. And even though the losing has kind of modified that culture, at least the perception of the team culture a little bit, Kidd just doesn't seem a good fit. And it's not so much from the specific incidents that he has in his past, which are definitely worth talking about. And certainly if you're the Celtics and you do talk to him, you need to get some type of clarity and have some type of conversation about. The bigger issue that I'm hearing about Kidd is trust. And there's a sense that organizations are not really sure they can trust Jason Kidd as much as they would like to trust him. When you think about the way he kind of, you know, his departures from teams has been a little bit kind of like, you know, you kind of give him the side eye, leaving organizations kind of high and dry. And the other thing, too, is that even though he's shown himself, I think, to be a pretty good coach, particularly his first year, which he has historically shown the ability to get that team more wins than they had the year before he arrived. But there's this sense that when that happens, he wants more say, more power, more influence, more impact beyond just coaching the team. And that's something that organizations, you know, it's one thing if you've won a title or you've taken a team deep in the playoffs 4, 5, 6 years in a row to want that added to the package. That's one thing. But, dude, this team was a non-lottery team, or excuse me, this team was a non-playoff team, and now they're a playoff team. That's great, but that doesn't warrant this all of a sudden increased power and influence and impact. And so there are some concerns without question with Kidd that I think if you're the Celtics, you're going to take a pass on him.
I forgot about that Brooklyn tenure too. Was that forgettable? Yeah. The KG Pierce team back then. And here they are back at the top again. We'll get to Chauncey Billups in just a minute. Got to shout out our sponsor, though, betonline.ag, who you know as well, Sherrod. Can do the read here yourself. You do a great job of it on A-List, but I'm going to shout out our championship pods here as you take your call there. betonline.ag, obviously, where you want to make your picks these NBA playoffs. Sherrod came through big time with his Utah Jazz pick when we discussed at the beginning of the playoffs teams that could rise to the top. I got to hand it to you. I'm liking them as well now that I've seen them get through round one and look really good so far against the Clippers despite their game three loss. You can find their odds as well as everybody else's after this Kyrie Irving injury. It'll be interesting to see what BetOnline's thinking about the Nets, who were heavy favorites in terms of the championship contenders there. Phoenix rising to the top. You have to consider them at this point, I would say, as a real deal contender to win it all. And then, of course, you get the Clippers powerhouse roster and the Bucks making up ground now. It's still, with these injuries coming up in Brooklyn, feels like a bit of a wide open race, more than you would see at this time of year. I'm going to pull up some of these futures, but who you got, Sherrod, at this point?
I mean, I think Brooklyn's in trouble. I really do. I think they're in serious trouble because, one, Milwaukee is feeling better about themselves. Two, Brooklyn can't combat Milwaukee's defense the way they're accustomed to, because it's one thing to be down one of your big three, but when you're down two of them, you become, you know, a very predictable team. And three, you know, Milwaukee, they were due to have some type of unplanned luck. When you look at the last couple of years, they had the best record and they couldn't even, you know, they couldn't even get to the conference finals or couldn't get to the NBA finals. And now they finish, I think, third in the East. And this might be the best path they've had of getting to the conference finals and potentially the NBA finals. So I feel a little bit better about the Bucks and their chances of getting past Brooklyn now. But Kevin Durant is so phenomenal that he's not going to go down without a fight. But, man, it's going to be very tough for Brooklyn to get out of this, particularly if Kyrie and that ankle, which that was a bad-looking ankle injury, if he's out for a game or two.
Clippers 160 plus 160 to beat the Jazz here. So they still think that series is going to be pretty tight after game three. Now Jazz still the favorites to take it at minus 180. 76ers heavy favorites now in that series, up 2-1 despite Embiid. his knee injury. Thought it was going to be a bigger issue for him. I gave the Hawks a real chance to win that series, but he's still coming through and doing his thing. And even if Brooklyn gets through this series, it looks like they're going to be a problem still with their defense and versatility. This has been a great postseason so far. You can bet on all these games, all these series over on betonline.ag, and make sure you use our code CLNS50 for a 50% welcome bonus on your first deposit. We'll keep hitting on the playoffs on the Garden Report as well as we continue to go through the playoffs here. But I want to talk about Chauncey Billups, who you covered in your time in Detroit in the 2000s, winning multiple championships there. Just one of the most unlikely finals teams ever. One of the great upsets, probably right up there with the Mavericks over the Heat in terms of them beating the Lakers and him becoming a legend who's probably going to go into the Hall of Fame one day. Started his career with the Celtics. Great point guard, one of the great point guards we've seen. And I love these anecdotes that you hear about, and I'm sure you're going to share a couple here as well. The one Bill Simmons and Ryan Russillo tossed out there about him playing for a team late in his career, the coach just saying, oh, do whatever on the inbounds, and Chauncey just stopping the play and, being adamant that we're going to set something up here in this inbounds late in the game. We're not just going to do whatever. I've heard a bunch of anecdotes of just his X's and O's mind and his cerebral approach to the game in terms of thinking like a coach, and now has stepped into the coaching field in LA this year out there with Cassell and under Ty Lue, is making a run at it, has been on TV, has done a million things that would project well here, and has that recognizability factor, I'm sure, the players on this team who grew up watching him. Probably everybody's favorite in terms of the resume here. How would you evaluate him as a candidate?
Well, I think Chauncey is going to make that short list. I mean, whatever that list is going to be, they're going to have competition for him, though. In fact, I would say that of all the candidates that the Celtics are going to interview, the stiffest competition to get Chauncey will be Portland. I think he's one of the few candidates that's going to have, I think, multiple teams that will do more than just interview him, but they will offer him the job. So if he's the guy that the Celtics are seriously thinking about, they're going to have to be very aggressive in their pursuit of him and make him an offer sooner rather than later. I know Rip Hamilton, his former teammate, former UConn star, TMZ caught up with him. And, Rip made it very clear that Chauncey is very interested in that Portland job. And as someone who has worked with those guys in the past, I know they're close. I know they talk. They are as close as two NBA players I've ever been around to being brothers could be. They just have that connection. So I definitely take Rip for his word. But the thing about Chauncey and the leadership, because you touched on it a minute ago, Bobby, he has a way of being a calming presence at all times. He's one of those few guys that rarely gets rattled, and he figured out early on how to make everyone understand that they have a role, and it's an important role for us to win. For example, Ben Wallace, who everyone, when they think about Ben Wallace, when he played for Detroit, great rebounder, elite defender. That's who he is. Chauncey recognized that Ben wanted to touch the ball a little bit more on offense. And so there must have been I can't remember at what point in the season it happened, but it got to the point where their first possession, they always threw it to Ben. And it didn't matter whether he scored or not. More times than not, he didn't. But it was Chauncey's way of saying, big fella, we need you to defend and rebound, but we're going to see if we can get you going on offense first. And they did this all the time. And I thought that for Ben Wallace, that was one of those bonding moments where your leader is making sure that he's being inclusive to what your needs are and what you want. And in return, you need to give us what we need to win. And it's little things like that that Chauncey consistently did throughout his career. He always played the game like a coach. And, shout out to Larry Brown, who probably did more for Chauncey in terms of thinking like a coach than any other coach that Chauncey was around. I just remember there were many days where Chauncey was ready to wring Larry Brown's neck because Larry was just being constantly changing up what he needed Chauncey to do. And it just got to the point where Chauncey finally understood it wasn't to just throw him off rhythm. It was for him to think, to be a thinker out there. And it got to the point where Larry just kind of let him go and didn't have to really navigate that and shift him in that direction. And again, Chauncey, he's one of the great thinkers. Now, obviously, you know, Chauncey is not perfect. There are certainly elements in his past that are not pretty. And to some extent, he's going to be held accountable for those. And he's going to have to probably address those at some point. But the overall body of work as a player, as a leader, I think he's won like the Joe Dumars Award for citizenship. Basically, it's the good guy award in the NBA. He's won it a couple of times when he played. There's so many receipts that I think are favorable for him that while there are some things that aren't pretty and they should be addressed, I don't think they're going to necessarily outweigh or mask over a lot of the positive things that he's done, both as a player and in his career after playing.
So it's kind of this new reckoning that we're having here in terms of, you know, sexual assault and that whole conversation coming up with his past. It's always worthy of bringing up and raising and questioning past indiscretions here, even though it happened, if we're talking 1997, that was the year before I was born. So 24 years just about now ago when he was a rookie with the Celtics, essentially sued along with Ron Mercer, the fellow rookie there, his first season in the NBA of rape. And the case ended in a settlement. You can find the case online. You can read just some damning and shocking allegations against him and Mercer as well, and Antoine Walker, it happening in Antoine Walker's house, the victim going to the hospital. You know, details I'm not necessarily going to get into here that we don't have to dive too deep on, but shocking allegations against Billups that ultimately ended up in a settlement. It's always tough. So when I was covering Syracuse basketball, there was a player on the team who someone reached out to me. This was probably my, one of my years covering the team there. And there was an allegation of sexual assault. So it's tough as a media. You can't just come out there and say, he's been accused of sexual assault, blah, 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 and make that kind of accusation. You kind of need something to go off there. So, you know, I go through the documents, I go through the school, I go through all these different things and try to find, paperwork here, something you can go off, something you can bring up in terms of reporting here. And there was nothing. And, you know, the victim didn't really want to bring it to the forefront. So I really had no basis to bring it up when it came to this player. So this is always a difficult thing you have to grapple with here. You know, someone's innocence versus someone's, credible accusations. You're always going to try to believe the victim and not doubt them and those kind of things. And I think that's what's good here is that we've shifted back towards really grilling the victim and, you know, trying to make them come up with perfect accusations and proof and all this kind of stuff toward, you know, grilling the possible perpetrator a little bit here. So I don't know how much Billups has addressed this in his past. Obviously, he's been able to go on to have a career there and do TV and now become an assistant through all this. But at the same time, I think our society's generally been willing to forgive alleged perpetrators and, you know, not so much grill not so much air with the victims here. And, you know, we haven't heard from the victim, still anonymous, and it was so long ago and all these different things, but I do think it's a positive sign that you do have people in both Portland and Boston, despite his immense credentials here and what he would bring being substantial to these organizations, people saying that this guy has this thing in his past. I'm not crazy about it when there's other qualified candidates here. Maybe you go with someone who doesn't have that kind of baggage. But I do think it's so good that we're having this conversation so much later and not just saying, like, we probably were in the past. It was a long time ago. Let's just move on.
Right, right. And that's important, not only because of just where we are as a society, but there has to be a level of transparency with these type of hires, and that's part of his narrative, right? You know, right or wrong, good or bad, it's there. It's part of it. I mean, there was court filings related to this that involved him, and I'd be curious to just see, you know, how he handles those type of questions, because, you know, I don't necessarily think it should be the dominant theme of his candidacy, it should not be ignored. And that to me is, again, there's a balance between those two things, but I don't think it's all that out of the realm of reality to find that balance between acknowledging this happening, having him, you know, address it in some capacity, and then being able to move on. Because obviously, you know, this we're talking about, I think it was 1997, when his rookie year when it happened. I think the settlement was like 3 years later. And so from 2000 to 2021, of 20 plus years, there hasn't been anything even remotely close to that particular incident in his background. And so that, you know, again, you don't ignore the incident, but if you're going to at least shine somewhat of a light on it, make sure that you shine a light on just all the time that has passed since then to see if there are any other, you know, times when that became an issue, which as far as I know, there haven't been. So,
yeah. I mean, what? How do you handle this in the media? I mean, you teach over there, BU. I do think it's so interesting from a media perspective because, you know, you don't want to falsely accuse someone at the same time. You want to raise these things. And I think overall, the way people have handled this has actually been pretty good. The fact that you can bring up these court filings here, that you can do all these different things to bring it to light and make it a consideration here, which it certainly has become. I think more and more people every single day are starting to bring this up. I know over on the Blazers Reddit page, someone brought this up and was like, do we really want this guy? From a media perspective, what do you do? Do you ask him that question at the press conference there and, you know, force him to reckon with it here? Do you, you know, as a columnist, say that we don't want this guy? Like, it's so interesting to me the ways you can address this as a media person. Because for me, like, you can't just leave it there. You can't just say this was a long time ago, you know, move on and this and that. Like, it, there's got to be some form of consequence if someone does something. And I think for a lot of people, especially decades ago, there weren't consequences. Like, this was a big topic when it came to Kobe's legacy. Like, how do you bring that into the fold there? It obviously wasn't going to be the first thing you talked about when he died. But at the same time, you're not going to fully put a myth around a guy who has that damning allegation in his past.
Yeah, yeah. And I think from a media standpoint, you just ask the damn question. But I think, and I say that in a very simplistic way, but the key is how you ask the question. Like, and that to me, it goes back to that whole, you know, sometimes it's not necessarily the message, but the messenger. Sometimes it's not necessarily the question, but how the question is asked. You know, for something like that, I would definitely put it into the context of, you know, this happened several years ago, but we are at a point in our society where these type of things, whether they happened in 1921 or 2021 or 1997, you know, there needs to be some sense of not necessarily asking you what happened, but just how do you reconcile with those who are bothered by that? What do you tell those people who are looking at you and they realize what happened 23 years ago? What do you tell them that should put them at ease or should make them feel comfortable with you being in this role that you're in? I mean, those are you have, but to me, it's, you have to be smart about it. I mean, I think that's probably the biggest thing. You have to think about how you want this question to be asked so that you can get a response. Because again, while it's certainly of value to know how he has kind of come to grips with all that, we can't ignore at the same time that this happened 24 years ago and that there's no real nothing even remotely close to that has transpired in his basketball career or his basketball life since then. But that doesn't mean you ignore it. So I think, again, the key is just asking the question, but asking it in a respectful manner. Asking it in a way that frankly can get you an answer. I mean, we go through this all the time with things that aren't nearly as serious as this. You know, when a guy is hurt and he just twists his ankle, sometimes you've got to ask it a certain way to get a response. Otherwise, guys will just shut down. And if they shut down, to me, I think when you ask questions and you don't think necessarily how you're phrasing them and you know they're going to shut down, you aren't really trying to seek the truth. You were just trying to get the question out. And if that's all you want is to get the question out, you're not doing your audience any good. So You got to think about that stuff before you ask the question. Don't just blurt stuff out, which, as you know, Bobby, it happens a lot, not just in Boston, but in a lot of cities where questions just blurted out with not a whole lot of thought behind them.
Well, yeah, this more and more has become like what excites me about sports media is the intersection between all these things we talk about in society. Mm-hmm. Some people get mad about politics getting brought up in sports, but it's always been there, you know, mm-hmm. for one reason or another. But this space especially, like, so much progress has been made on sexual assault and rape in terms of just talking about it. But I saw it, like, in my last year at Syracuse, a page got created for victims to come and speak out about things, and numerous people's names were thrown around, and it was very detailed, the accounts that were put out there about certain people and identifying them by name anonymously. It was a very powerful moment for me to, especially as a man, to see the kinds of things that women were going through on campus. You don't hear about it. It's not talked about a lot. And a lot of the time we know there's not justice served in many of these circumstances. And it killed me because the response ultimately to it was some powerful people coming together, it seemed, and shutting the page down with threats of lawsuits and, you know, just really trying to go after this page and get shut down. They were ultimately successful. So you had this great week, I thought, where people were held accountable. People had to talk to their friends who they knew who were being named as perpetrators. And ultimately it ended with a blip and not a huge level of accountability and it being thrown in the shadows. And it was tough for me because some very powerful people on campus and in Syracuse history were named on that list. And I wonder behind the scenes if those were the people ultimately who were behind the pressure to shut this page down. And that sticks with me more than anything else from college, that moment where people were trying to shed light on something and through threats were shut down. And that still shows me that we have so far to go when it comes to this issue that I think is just a lot of the times thrown to the side, especially when it comes to powerful people who get mythologized a lot of the time. And you don't want to have to rethink of someone's legacy who might have done everything else positive in their life, but possibly ruined someone's life at one point.
Yeah, and again, we live in a society where litigation isn't just something that happens; it's something that happens all the time. And there's a fear of that, and that fear often drives people to try to shut down or mute or silence voices that will force that litigation to take place. And it's not right. We know that, but part of fixing it is understanding what we're trying to fix. And so I love the fact that we're in a society now where women are way more comfortable speaking out on things that they should be comfortable speaking out on because they were the ones that were wrong. And we're not where we need to be, but we're better than we were. And that's by no means a consolation prize or anything like that. It's just the reality of where we are as a society when it comes to sexual assault. Yeah. And so, again, the key is just trying to be better for those of us who are older, who have sons, trying to educate them as much as we can on, to be frank, how to treat women and how to respect women and how to respect women athletes, women non-athletes, women who are in a business world, women who work at the fast food restaurant. That's a lot of what this comes down to is a lack of respect. And when you are an athlete, when you have a certain power, that at least power in your head, you feel that the rules don't apply to you. And that's a lot of times what this comes down to is just some knucklehead thinks that he's above the law. That's why there are certain college coaches who I would never in life have anyone that I'm related to play for. Because they've shown a willingness to not just embrace those type of individuals, but when it becomes clear as day that those athletes have done some of these horrendous atrocities to women, they keep them around. Or they find them a place to go where they send them to a buddy of theirs. And that's just, it's disgusting.
Yeah.
It's disgusting.
I saw a story out of Michigan too, Michigan football years ago of, you know, men being raped in that circumstance by a doctor who you know, a coach was associated with there. So it's on both too. Obviously, women are in large part are the victims of these crimes, but men are in a circumstance where if it happens to them, there's even a greater taboo situation of coming out and, you know, speaking what they've been through. So when I hear people say like, oh, keep politics out of my sports, well, think of the things that have been covered up by not having politics in sports and societal issues brought up around sports. What terrible things have happened to people just because of that silence. The conversations that we're able to have about this now at this point are very powerful and hopefully are going to make people rethink things and change the way sports operate when it comes to those who have been neglected and, you know, obviously taken advantage of. So glad people are bringing that up when it comes to Billups. It should be considered in his candidacy. I love the credentials that he brings to the table here, but the question does have to be asked. Do the Celtics want to be associated with this? What is accountability at the end of the day when it comes to Billups? Has he done enough? I think these are the answers we're still trying to find when it comes to this type of thing. So thanks for joining me here. Talk about it, Sherrod. Always a great conversation with you. And again, I've been blessed to have you as a bit of a mentor here and someone I've always looked up to watching the Celtics coverage. Again, we'll talk about your journey another day. We've gone on forever here about some of the relevant issues, but we'll have you back on again here on Dome Theory and do what we usually do here, hit on people's journeys and appreciate all that you've brought to the table here on the show. Love your podcast, the A-List podcast. You have to listen to it. Gary Washburn brought the fire as he always does with Kwani Lewis there as well, co-hosting alongside Sherrod. It's a great show. I've enjoyed listening there just about every episode you put out and many more to come on a weekly basis here on CLNS Media. Check it out on YouTube, subscribe to it on Spotify, iTunes, all those places. Who is coming up this week on the show, Sherrod? You got plans yet?
I need to get confirmation, so I can't say who. I need to get confirmation from them. Hopefully I'll get that within the next day. But we'll have somebody. We'll have somebody.
All right. Pretty good. Stay tuned to social media. I'm sure you're going to hear about it there first. Sherrod, thanks so much for coming on, and thanks for having a conversation here and bringing so much info on these coaches.
Not a problem, Bobby. Anytime. You know how to find me.